Scripture, natural things are natural, because that is the meaning of essence. That, by virtue of which a thing is what it is. This question has been given an answer, but now a more complicated and difficult question is asked.
Well, coming to another meaning of nature, I thought the old one, an artifact, didn't have a nature.
Nor will it have it here. He's speaking now of the truth, of the nature and the essence of the things which of the beings which are by nature.
No, but in the discussion of the leading text.
No, there he has led up to, he says, one can perhaps say this follows, he has led up to that by saying, primarily we distinguish between natural things and artifacts. Artifacts, but precisely regarding artifacts, we make a distinction between the thing and the nature of the thing. Yeah? And precisely regarding artifacts, we say, for example, that wood is the nature in the chair. And then he goes on from that to the wider meaning, or to the more precise meaning of the natural things. Artifacts and artifacts point away from themselves to others. Now, there is, the deeper questions which arise here we cannot possibly go into, but I can only indicate. You must not forget that man can take very, very bearings without ever knowing anything of nature as nature. We are the heirs to this creature living, and he as a baby almost is saying naturally. And the whole thing is in that. But that is not natural. I mean, that is not, in the sense that it does not belong to man as man. And for me, the simple example, directly accessible, is the Old Testament. There is no word, no Hebrew word for nature. The word which was used in the Middle Ages and in modern times in Hebrew for nature is derived via the Syriac from a Greek word which in Greek means character. 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 What you put on a coin? How do you call that? The stamp. And the Hebrew word also shows the origin. The stamp. And that shows the meaning that nature meant in classical antiquity primarily something different from what it means now. Nature is a stamp. Yeah? That's the characteristic, the form. Yeah, and it is, I mean, that how and what is it, therefore the question for a true interpretation of such text would of course be to understand the more fundamental premises on the basis of which human beings, in this case the Greek, could see something like nature. For example, that there are stamps of being, animals are different from plants, and they from men, and they all from stars. And of course, you only have to read the first chapter of Genesis to read that it's built on these distinctions. But it is not understood in terms of nature. There is a much more common expression which I believe occurs in all languages, at least all languages, not only which I know, but where I was able to question natives, like Sanskrit and Chinese and so on, and which is a biblical word and which even occurs in the Greek definition of time, and that is the way of a thing, the custom of a thing. That, I would say, is the most elementary trace out of which nature emerges on the basis of certain very specific premises. Now that you see, of course, immediately that things have different ways. Yeah? Look at a dog and how he behaves, what is the way of living and doing it, in contradistinction to that of a cat. This occurs in the way of things that occurs in the Old Testament and is also very common and fundamental word in Sanskrit as well as in Chinese. And I imagine that there is an equivalent of that everywhere. Being different things have different ways. And the reflections that these different things are not really different individuals. Dog number one, dog number two, although they too have different ways when you observe them closely. But we think primarily, of course, of the different ways of the kinds of things. Yeah? Not of the individuals, the kinds of things. That is an important indicator. I remember that a biblical expression like menstruation is the way of women. That would be in Greek the nature, belongs to the nature of it. But this nature implies this particular interpretation of way. And another equivalent of nature, another primary form of what the Greeks understand by nature is the notion of custom. Different things have different customs. In this stage of reflection, it is not distinguished. For example, the Gauls, let us assume, have the custom of getting drunk or whatever their specialty was, getting much drunk. This is the custom of the Gauls. And the other tribes have different customs. The essential difference between these different kinds of customs and the different natural customs of dogs, lions, etc., is not made a theme. And even if you speak of ways in this primary way, you have not yet made explicit the fundamental distinction, for example, between natural things and abstract. For in the Greek reflection, that is in the foreground from the very beginning, this fundamental difference. The word physis occurs only once in Homer, only once, in a very important context. And there it characteristic has the meaning of the stamp, or the character, and not the other meaning. The nature of her, that is about the meaning which it has in this unique place in Homer. No, that would be a mere speculation on my part, and it surely has something to do the Old Testament, that's a very highly developed reflection, of course, although not philosophic reflection, and that is the whole thought is connected, to put it cautiously, with the notion of the creation, that everything has been created. Yeah? And now, you know from Storms and other passages that the word is called the artifact of God. More literally than say, it's the work of the hands of God. Now, clearly, if a mountain is a work of the hands of God, and this is a work of the hands of man, then the overarching concept of any being would be work of hands of. Yes? And you have to make a distinction between divine and human. The Greeks were by no means unfamiliar with that, as you could see from a passage in the Plato's Sophist, where the whole universe is described as the work of the divine art technique, as distinguished from the products of human art. Yeah? But in Greek thought, in Greek understanding, this understanding of the natural things that he said as works of divine art was not so determined from the outset, as you see then in the extreme doctrines like Democritus, where there is nothing of the sort, you know. The Greeks were open to that possibility, the old individuals were not. How it is in other languages, I know much less. In Sanskrit, there is a certain big problem here. But from my questioning cross-examining of the Hindu, it appeared to me that the Sanskrit word dharma is really the way. You know, Dharma is ordinary translated by religion. But if you ask more closely, you see it is truly, of course, the Hindu religion. I is the way of the Hindu. But that is not good enough. If my friend's first examination is good enough, it is the way of men, of man. And the others, human beings simply have deviated from that way. Just, and there, in the same sense, there is also a way of iron, a dharma of iron, whatever it may be. Then everyone would have to go surely there to this trace of. In other words, to understand, to take one's bearings in the light of the notion of nature is not, quote, natural. I mean, it is not given to man from the moment of his appearance as a species or as a celestial individual to make this system. You know, that is based on very definite principles.
Because one man is easily recognized, but he left no trace of it, as was other things. But we have to try our best to do that and see when to move accordingly.
I hope I don't have to state again that in an engaging in this kind of study of Plato's work, we are just doing merely historical studies about some men dead millennia ago, and we should rather be concerned, and I do not deny that we should, with what is going on today in Vietnam and Santo Domingo. But I have a hunch that our thinking about Santo Domingo and Vietnam will be improved if we take this roundabout way of thinking about the present. Now, there is another dialogue, one moment, please. There is another dialogue to which we are pointed by the Protagoras. Less visibly, but nonetheless fortunate. I noted the fact that some of the pupils of the Sophists mentioned by Socrates. You remember when he comes in and sees these and these with Protagoras, these and these with Hippias, and these and these with others. Some of these pupils of the Sophists reappear as speaking characters. In one of the most magnificent Platonic works, in the Symposium of Banquet. And this is, to begin with, very hard to understand. What does Protagoras have to do with the Symposium? Now, in the Protagoras, the banquet culminates in a speech by Socrates. It is not a dialogue in the ordinary sense, because we have rather a sequence of speeches, of subsequent speeches. The last speech is that by Socrates. Well, in one sense it isn't, because after Socrates is through, a drunken man crashes the party, if this is a proper expression, and makes speech on Socrates, that's Alcibiades. But Alcibiades speaks about Socrates, whereas the speeches all dealt with the same theme, the herald, not. Now, in the banquet, Socrates tells to the friends there, he reveals to them a secret which had been revealed to him by that extraordinary woman, Diotima. Incidentally, there is another obvious connection between the two dialogues. At the beginning, or near the beginning of the Protagoras, Socrates is standing in the rest before the house in silent meditation. The same happens at the beginning of the banquet, and nowhere else. Plato could not have made clear the connection. Now, it is of course possible, that would lead us much too far, that these speeches about Eros, prior to Socrates' speech, are in a way sophistic speeches. Speeches not in the ordinary sense of the word based on illegitimate inferences, but on the cosmology to which the Sophists adhere. That's what it is. But the fact that Plato almost dots the T's and crosses the T's and dots the I's in order to draw attention to the relation between the Protagoras and Banquet forces us to take this quite seriously. Now, this is the end of what I shall say coherently, and we have some time left for friendly or unfriendly exchange.
Minor point. Between 4 and 6, I don't see where to put the number 5 in.
That order is not very, very, very good. But I'll be glad to tell you. That you see the amount of my disorderliness, I will tell you. Now, 1 second. Number 5,
please. Is it that you distinguish the point of, in Protagoras, the discussion is chiefly with the type of role, and then the question of for the sake of whom is it?
This is number 5. So it is silently suggests to God as the highest service of God. So it is openly suggests to Protagoras the true kind of stuff. What? The exam question. I'm glad that there is one memory of common sense, bringing us back from to Abba. There is no exam question. No question. Socrates' critique of Protagoras' political science or political art, whatever you like. Yes?
It seems to me that this may be a completely wrong impression, but that the dangers from Protagoras didn't become clear, or wouldn't have become clear to Hippocrates, except that, well, he didn't know what virtue was, and that I suppose is a very considerable danger.
But one bad, very good. In other words, Protagoras was not shown up as a corrupter of the young in a way which Socrates could understand. That's quite true. But still, something happened which was bound to affect Hippocrates' eagerness to become a pupil of Hippocrates. Yeah? And what was that?
Yes.
Good. And now, why is this better? Why is this better than debunking? Than showing up Protagoras as a corruptor of the youth? Why is this better? Because I make one example. Socrates is a reason, is a wise man, and will choose a wise course of action. Why is it better to deflate Protagoras than to present him as a corruptor of the young? This kind of questions we are concerned today, all the time, whether we know it or not. Yes?
Because then he's appealing to Hippocrates' courage and manliness rather than to his possibly very narrow moderation and temperament, which would be necessary to keep him away from corruption.
Yes, that is true, but it is a bit complicated.
To show him up as a corruptor, you would have to let him explain his whole course of teaching of how to gain power and so forth, which would be much more effective.
Protagoras would be too clever. He would then find a way out of that.
Hippocrates shows at the beginning of the discussion Socrates that he's aware that there's something shameful about being a Sophist by blushing, but that doesn't disturb him. In order to really deter Hippocrates from becoming a Sophist, that it's not really a good means to the end he wants. It's not merely that the end is shameful, but the fact that he's a corruptor.
But he doesn't learn, as Mr. Brill pointed out. He does not, assuming that Hippocrates is not very intelligent, and I think that's a fair assumption, he doesn't notice that Bhagavatam is a corruptor. Bhagavatam will contradict himself and he's reduced to silence, and Sukharit is the winner in all these contests that everyone can see, and this Hippocrates also will see. And this, of course, since he was hitherto regarded Hippocrates as wisdom incarnate, where one must spend lots of money to be associated, he sees, no, it's not so hard. I can have it cheaper than I go to Sukharit, because it's our friend.
And I
think
this might be true of
Sukharit,
first of all, if you make an attack on a person's character, as opposed to simply showing the fool, we call a person a fool, especially in a place where he's surrounded by friends, it's too easy for him to simply say he was an immoderate man, and why should you listen to him?
Yeah.
The second thing is that, however, when the same sort of attack is reversed, when you have a majority and when you are surrounded by friends, and the man who is called the corrupter of youth is held out alone as an apology, the defense cannot be made in the same way, and something needs to come out of it.
Yeah, but is there not, did you never hear the word character assassination? And that's an accusation of if Sukharit could simply say, Protagoras, you are a wicked man, ruining these people, that this would be a most improper conduct in such, because after Protagoras behaved with ordinary courtesy, and you cannot do that. There is a certain vanity was taken for granted in Athens, so it acts always on the regular. But you want to know.
People in general, young men of Hippocrates type in particular, are attracted to what appears to be dangerous and corrupting, whereas they're not very much attracted at all.
Are not attracted by?
A fool. A fool.
Yeah.
If Protagoras can be shown to have lost the verbal vowel,
yeah,
he will lose much of his attractiveness.
Yeah, sure.
For Socrates to say that it is dangerous for Hippocrates studying with Protagoras,
increase
the attraction in a certain.
He said that.
And Hippocrates was not at all impressed.
No.
And to show it would not impress Hippocrates nearly as much as simply to show that Protagoras is not that wonderful.
Yeah, that I was mixing because the deflating of the banknote. Mr. Levy?
Socrates too is accused of a corrupting the youth, not as a philosopher, but because the people who have to judge these things might obviously get that he's been a philosopher and a sophist.
Yeah, that
Socrates
comes much close.
Socrates can say against him that the people would be against Socrates, but what you had to do is to
I think that is a point which I would, from which I would start. I would say it would do greater harm to Hippocrates to become just a hater of sophists than to be induced in a particular case not to become a pupil of sophists, because he would not have discrimination enough to distinguish between a sophist and a philosopher. And the fact that he adheres to Sukharit is never explained, but I suppose Sukharit was somehow known to his family, and you know, a fellow whom you can trust and an easygoing man, you just step in whenever you like, and you and who never takes anything ill, but you know.
Can I ask, does Socrates go to visit Protagoras with the assumption that he's unwise, or is there something he finds out?
No, I mean, he had seen him before, and he knew who Protagoras, that I would take for granted, he knew Protagoras, but what he wanted, if we disregard his moral motive as a desire to help Hippocrates, and if we disregard that entirely, I think it had this somewhat whimsical motive to see how Srila Protagoras acts in such a situation, because he had probably had never seen it there. Yes?
Then I understand you to say that those dialogues are related to one another in groups?
Yes, but say dialogue A belonging to group Alpha. It by this very fact may also belong to a group Beta. Yeah? It is not very simple to understand.
They are really connected.
Yeah, they are connected. I mean, but it is not so, not the Plato's dialogues as a whole are an imitation of the world, of the cosmos. Now, not everything in the world is directly connected with everything else, but an indirect connection always exists. That makes sense. Yeah.
Well, I didn't understand why you said before that it would be better for Socrates to become a possible pupil of Socrates than to become a mere hater of Socrates. I mean, I would see that it would be better for Socrates as a philosopher than to be a hater. It would seem that Socrates' character, he would be a man of very fine character and still be a Sophist and philosopher. I mean,
wouldn't
he be better off
getting Socrates? No, but Socrates would he not be better off if he were a pupil, if he would become a pupil of Protagoras? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean, I say that you suggested, if I understood, that it would be better that he be a pupil of Protagoras than a mere hater of Socrates.
No, I didn't say, no, he should not be a pupil of Protagoras. But he should also not be a hater of Sophists, because he could not be, in this particular case, thanks to the presence of Socrates in Athens, it was possible to deflate this particular charlatan. Yeah? But there are not always Socrates around, and as I know from my youth, and some of you may not yet know it because you are too young, it takes some time until you can distinguish between charlatans and non-charlatans. I mean, there are gross cases where men are so patently charlatans that even a student of 18 or 19 would not be fooled. But in other cases, more stuff.
Well, suppose there were some people, maybe there are many people that who just don't have the ability, they will never be able to discriminate
between the. Yeah, but therefore they had a very simple weapon against that. Like the eunuch. Sophists be damned. And then unable to distinguish between the Sophists and Socrates. And the eunuch even thought that poor Hippocrates is a Sophist. You remember?
That would be better, but
it is a certain protection, but it is also, of course, a danger. You know, I mean, these organizations which preserve the established, and they can also get out of hand. They need an injection of wisdom. I mean, I believe you are familiar with parallels from the American present. Yeah? I mean, these things, you know, there is some reason, some discernment, some discretion. It's necessary. And Socrates was a conservative man. But he was conservative in a broader way. They keep the old practice and the old orders, but in such a way that freedom of thought, of thinking, is possible, at least for those who can be, who will make a good use for them. But since the legislator, poor fellow, cannot make this distinction between those who will make a good use and those who make a bad use, you cannot have simply a law, because a law would be unable to. How will you distinguish by a legal provision between a philosopher and Sophist? Because if you do, the Sophist will appear as philosophers, very simple. Yeah? I mean, that is clever. People can evade laws, and especially laws of that kind, there is no legal possibility of drawing the distinction. Isn't the distinction? Thoughtful and honest men can make the distinction properly and will make it, But where is the guarantee that the judges or the magistrates will always be thoughtful and honest men? There is no justice. There are some institutional safeguards. One can have as some lines can be drawn somewhere. That is true. It is true. For example, there is no obvious consequence from the need for freedom of thought, that there must be perfect freedom for obscenity, as some Berkeley students seem to have thought. Yeah? This, I believe, is an illegitimate conclusion, because there is no thought involved in that, I think. And you can have otherwise, but we have to muddle through there. But this muddling through may be, in the case of men of judgment, not be muddling through at all, but clear judgment in this case, different from a clear judgment in another case. That is possible.
Well, so is not Pythagoras clearly trying to say, in effect, too, that teaching should carry with it a moral significance? A moral significance?
No.
Along with the
Protagoras.
That Protagoras says. I mean, he seems to be interested in introducing the moral element into teaching here, too.
Protagoras doesn't say that.
He doesn't say it, though.
No, and. Yeah, but what does that mean? Perhaps it means not more than cleverness and courage, i.e. nerve, combined. That is not exactly what we ordinarily put the emphasis on, and which is not what we ordinarily understand by decency, because Mr. Giancano, I'm sure, has this quality towards more on above average degree, and yet I wouldn't be, that wasn't the point. Yeah, but then it's hard to say that Protagoras is in an ordinary sense of the term a decent man, I mean that it didn't steal silver spoons, and as we have seen from the beautiful address he made at the end of the speeches of it, he is not envious, not petty, and speaks very finely about how promising this young man is, a relatively young man, Socrates is, and so he is truly a nice man. I mean, we must never make the mistake, which is so easy to make, that we identify ourselves simply with a good character. We must also make an application to ourselves and raise the question, am I such a good character? Of course, it goes without saying, at the most important application. But still, since knowledge or awareness is an important ingredient of decency, we must also, to learn the right standards is important for acting rightly. Yeah? Although it is not the same. That is a great error apparently committed by Socrates, that he thinks if I know the right thing, I will do it. And the vulgar always say that isn't true, and the vulgar are right in this. That's the problem. Yes, Mr. Murden? Agreement has here this wide meaning. They reached an agreement. Some difficulty came up.
Well, why would he put it in? I don't see it. Why is it placed in the
dialogue? I remember I had some thoughts. It's of course very striking that Socrates does not report his part of the conversation. Where is it? And then let's see. Yes, that's correct. Yes, about some logos. They conversed about some logos who had occurred to them, which had occurred on the way. lest it be become incomplete, we completed it and then we went in. And standing in the four hour, we argued until we had agreed with each other. But still the question is, of course, Plato makes us very curious. What was it? He tells Socrates everything, every detail, and does not this little anything. I do not know, and if you don't mind with this grateful procedure, I will simply look up whether something had occurred to me when I read that. In briefly. Yeah, this is, I said here that this logos between Socrates and Hippocrates is undisclosed, and it surely proves that not every logos is disclosed. They completed that logos while standing, not walking, and this we discussed it at the time. And I said this contrasts with the uncompleted conversation with Protagoras, which follows. Yes, that is obviously incomplete because they don't know what virtue. But here they reach. Yes, I did not dare to make any guess as what the substance of. Perhaps one can do it by a more careful reading of the conversation with Hippocrates than we have done. Yes. But it is not wise to concentrate one's attention to this particularly on this particularly hard nut, and not concentrate first on the things which one can understand. Yeah. Otherwise, one would waste much time. Yes. Yes.
What is the danger?
A boy comes to school and sees the president or the dean or some secretaries, whatever it is. That doesn't give you, you know, or if you can also say the public relations man. No instruction is given. How do you know that Protagoras in these instructions wouldn't say laws are bunk? You have to comply externally with them, but don't answer them. How do you know?
Well, we don't know, then we have to wonder why
Socrates
went along with the
doctrine. But since you do not know, since Hippocrates doesn't know, Socrates is absolutely justified in telling him, don't take chances, because teachings are not things like bread, like food, fish or whatever it is, which you buy in the marketplace, and you have them in a vessel. You don't eat them on the market. But the teaching you cannot wrap up, and I take it home, and then I will wash it and so, but you take it in immediately, and the damage which has been caused is there. So that makes this clear at great length. You remember that?
I remember that, but my question is, in other words, this dialogue was never called the danger of prophecy, as prophecy. You know, like the danger
I think a closer study would show, and Thurman has shown it, why is Protagoras so much embarrassed by the proposition that you cannot be prudent without being just. Why is he embarrassed by that? Because he believes that you can very well be a shrewd and very successful in the world without being just. And if you believe that, and you deal with such matters in your classroom, so to speak, we are not in Protagoras' classroom, mind you. This is the answer, as it were, before he registered for Protagoras' courses, and Here we are still in the Madison Avenue book, not in the English. Yes.
I think
it's
a question. Hippocrates obviously has political ambition.
I beg your pardon.
Political ambition.
Yes, so we're young. Yeah. How is this there to be taken? We don't know. It's fairly young. But since there are all kinds of politicians, you know, even taking ordinary politician standards, he could might be quite good run-of-the-mill politician for all we know. Yeah? Sure, he has political ambition. Yes.
Well, it's just as famous as that, this I believe is a question that Mr. Levy raised earlier in the quarter, and he said he would defer it until we finish the dialogue. Hippocrates will now leave Protector, apparently with the same ambitions that he had.
Yes.
And hopefully will pick up the art of rhetoric somewhere or another so that he can gain the power that he might desire. Now, what are Socrates' plans to combat this? Does he hope to get Hippocrates to come to his political room? Or does he.
Perhaps, so that is hard to say. The initiative is entirely with Hippocrates, and there is no sign that Socrates takes an eager positive interest in Hippocrates. He has the decent negative interest. If you see a man about to fall into a ditch with poisonous fumes, you will warn him. Yeah?
So
and that's what Socrates does.
Would that have been Hippocrates? I mean, if Hippocrates is just going to be left drifting with all the perhaps corrupt politicians of Athens at the time.
Yeah, that is the point.
Wouldn't he be better off?
The question is this: if he had acquired, in addition, powerful tools, as he might acquire through learning rhetoric, he would be good. That is quite true. I mean, that is particularly clear in the Nino, but also in other dialogues. So that is, he disagrees with the Sophists, and in that respect he agrees with the majority of the citizens, but on different grounds. In the case of the majority of citizens, at best, a kind of healthy instinct, but they don't know. In the Mino, the accuser of Socrates, Anytus, says hates the Sophists. But then Socrates asks him, "Did you ever see one?" "No, I don't want to see them. I don't want to know nothing about them. I just hate them." Now this is perhaps a good protection up to a certain point, but it is also a weak side. Yeah? You know, you must know your enemy. And you cannot simply leave it at hating and killing. Yes.
Well, the sophistry is supposed to be, according to the team of the gorgeous, sophistry is the sham legislative art. And rhetoric is the sham art of justice. But
yes.
From this last comment, it would seem that one thing that has been forgotten about is in the Protagoras is in fact the legislative art. I mean, in the very beginning they talked about in terms of buying food for the body, you would need either a doctor or a trainer. And then when they talked about food for the soul, they just mentioned the doctor of the soul, no trainer of the soul. The very beginning And throughout, there has been no discussion of the legislative art as such. And we see Socrates doesn't try to become a trainer of the soul of Hippocrates. He just sort of becomes a doctor, you know, by saving him from the disease. But
you could even say he helped out the soul.
So why would it be then in the discussion of sophistry, or supposed to be the companion of the gorgeous covering sophistry?
But that's
completely
what we do. There is no, I mean, as I said it, in the gorgeous, Socrates proposes to the master rhetorician what the true rhetoric. In the Protagoras, he does not suggest to the master sophist what a true sophist would be. That is fine. I mean, you cannot look for that in the Protagoras. You would have to turn that is that only dialogue called Sophist. And in that you would probably find an answer. I don't think in general the dialogue is correctly devoted to Sophist, like the two Hippias and the Eurydemus. They would probably find it. They have to leave it at that. And this is the idea of the understanding of the dialogue would be to discover that fundamental finite or purpose of an individual dialogue from which all other features of the dialogue flow with perfect clarity and certainty. And I believe that the question of the concealment of is broader from this point of view. You arrive at the largest number of features which I have enumerated by starting from red. In order to sham enlightenment, to use the modern for which Protagoras stands. It is sham enlightenment not only because the doctrines which it spreads are not true and sound, but also because it is of course not quite, it lacks that frankness which it claims. Mr. Dryan, what did you last say?
Right after stating the question, you referred to Aristotle's judgment on the topic, that they reduced the political art to rhetoric.
Yes.
I would like to know what significance there is on this question in Protagoras' treatment in the myth, where he reduces or defines the gift of Zeus, or what we think is political virtue, to punishment, because there, I got the impression that there's an example, there's a spot where there is the recognition of the need for pressure or coercion. It may not be
true. And it's a very good point. I do not know how I can answer that so easily. And let me see, what struck me most in the myth, in Mary's readings of it, is this, that what he wanted to make clear is the difference between nature, i.e. what the subterranean god working without light, including Epimetheus, the art, that what Prometheus stole from heaven, and what we call morality, and what for Protagoras would be merely conventional. Now, what he means, I mean, if we disregard the mythical language of a gift of Zeus, it means simply ordinary decency is a product of social pressure. The punishment in the wider sense, where it does not mean merely going to jail and being executed and paying fines, but also disgrace is, of course, also punishment. This is, in other words, it has no truth in itself. That's the point. Whereas the arts all have truth in themselves. The other, and the untruth is proven by the fact that in the case of this kind of vices or vicious action, nothing bad happens to the doer unless he is detected. And this shows the artificial character. Whereas if you overeat, to use my old example, you may be in the strictest privacy, you will be punished for it. Yeah? I mean, if you don't know it, ask anyone who ever eat or ate or drank too much. This takes place wholly independent of the death. This notion is any bad action which is punished only when detected, it's not intrinsically bad. An intrinsically bad action is one which punishes itself. Xenophon alludes occasionally to these strange things from a different point of view, from a Socratic point of view. Roughly says that the penal laws, as ordinarily framed, at least in olden times, are untrue assertions. So if it says, he who does this and this will be punished in this way, in order to make it true, you would have to ask, if detected. Now, to make a penal law true in this sense means, of course, to hold it up for ridicule. So, as it were, to encourage people to prevent their detection. So this is what it is. But the point is, that is certainly what you say. Now, then we must... Yes, but what could one say to this in reply to your very good point? Does broad cover reduce the body to get hard to recognize? Does it do that? You are quite right. His theory in the myth and also non-mythical later contradicts that. But do we have any other evidence that he did that? I mean, from the broad cover.
Then I think we might want to distinguish his political life from that. Common
gift of truth, which he doesn't talk about, but he, it's not there, but we know it's not there because it's skipped over. It is something different. But he doesn't, that point that we talked about, education, it's part of it. Yeah, but it's not his whole doctrine based on the premise that virtue is not knowledge. And surely, that's clear. And therefore, it should not be teachable, so what is it? Now, of course, he says it is teachable, but what does he understand by teachable? If the social pressure apparatus is a form of teaching, as a very broad and lax use of the word teaching, yes? Is it not? In other words, you are right, he has to reconsider. With all due respect, Aristotle's statement about sophistry, reducing, or almost reducing the statement, somewhat qualified, to rhetoric, and perhaps we must say Protagoras is presented in that the public doesn't fall under this heading. I can do more. Well, I don't say I wish you a nice vacation, as I always say as a end of class, because you still have to undergo that humiliation, the examination. What was the date?
You said June 1.
Did I say that? Well, you. Oh, yes. I see. And I don't have to be here then. And I will find a reliable student. So we pick some. Where will you put him?
Couldn't it be with Mrs. Pettigrew?
Yes, that would be simple. Yeah. You know who Mrs. Pettigrew is in the office. And if you, those of you who are, I don't say eager, but who are willing to pass this examination, would give it to Mrs. Pettigrew on the forenoon of June 1st. That I can come into the possession of the examination papers in the afternoon. And please, tide them. This is a little benefit I hope to reap from the fact that you write them at home. Type them to the, and type also your name. Then you see also the case of Master Dean. The primacy, the preponderance of the shape or form. Only the shape and form is here not thought about by an artificer standing side by side and having a vision of the thing to which he arranges the material, but this is what it is thought about without any such man or dog, by the way. Yeah? You know? Yeah. which you would also use from other people's things, you know. The polish is something in between an after being an after. And I think one can say what is the polish is an after is that it is required by the nature of man, but not regarding its coming to be, and not even regarding its being. That is, is of course a very difficult question, I would say. But that should be clear. I mean, the common opinion of the poly is not simply a natural poly. Also, catches it how it could have been. You know, you spread, you generate children, and they generate positive, and then you get gradually a clan. Yeah? And then the clan can become so large that it's a poly. But that is not as a good thing, but that is not essentially necessary. The settling together of a number of different clans, of different clans, on the basis of deliberation, they are large enough and they fit each other and this kind of thing, that is a much more sensitive, and in this sense, a more natural beginning of the poly. Yeah? So. And then there must be the carpenter or whatever, the maker. And then there must be an outline in his mind of how the thing will look, a house, there, whatever it may be. And fourth and third, the end of earth. Because the form is defined in these cases by the purpose. That is usually the purpose of a chair to sit on. And then we make the form and shape of the chair that is used to the human body today. So the end is the beginning. The beginning of the whole process. Now if we start from that and say in natural things too we look for the outer thing and we look for the through thing. And we look also for the shape. Must we also look for and the shape or form? Must we not also look for an end? And to which Aristotle says, yes, under one condition, that you understand that in the case of naturalism, form and end are identical. So a dog generates a dog. Not for another end, many for example, to be fed in his old age by the generation of dogs, but he generates dogs for the sake of generating dogs, for the sake of the preservation of the species, as he would say, but perhaps not living as deeply as Aristotle did. But and more precisely, we would even have to say that the three causes coincide because dog generates dog, yeah? It is generated as a traditional cause. Generates dog, formal cause, for the sake of generating dog, finally. And then as a body and special bodily part and position and so forth, which from this point of view considers the matter, it would remain. But that comes up later on in the physics, and the second book of physics, we cannot read that, unfortunately, we cannot read that here because we are in a political science department, so let's forget that. But at least, I hope even those who are sold on the most severe distinction of departments will see that this is not entirely irrelevant, because if you don't go into this kind of trans-political reflection. You can't stop at the merely political, then you have to go at turn to replace this kind of thing, or analogous thing, by scientific methodology, which is as little political science in the narrow sense as Aristotelian physics. Yeah? Or you get it in all kinds of indirect ways, for example, by assuming that psychology as it is now treated is an unquestionable science, yeah, that you can do, then you just pass a buck to some other so-called empirical and positive science without having examined whether that it lifts up the claim, which is also perhaps very scientific but not very thoughtful or philosophic to do. So I think with this apology, we leave it at this apology. And next time, Mr. Jack, we will come back to really much simpler questions, namely what a wise father 2,000 years ago had to say to his somewhat dubious son as to how he should conduct himself in order to be a good and decent man. And that's easier to follow. Thank you.